You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a lovely eclectic show for you today. Our studio guest is Anne Atkins, talking about her new novel, An Elegant Solution. We'll also hear from children's life coach Zelna Lawrence on her book, The Secret Parent. And Ted Powell will be talking all things royal, his book, King Edward VIII, An American Life. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Anne. Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
I say it's an eclectic show. The thing that links Zelna and Ted is they're both passionate about their subjects working with children. And Ted, as we'll hear, has got a collection of memorabilia about Edward VIII. Very passionate about that. What's your passion?
Oh, Lee, how difficult. I think I've got too many passions. I would find it very difficult to single it down to one. My children, my husband, the love of my life. Writing is a real passion of mine. Words, I'm very passionate about words.
Most people might know you from Thought for the Day, and you often express passionate opinions in that slot on the Radio 4 Today programme.
Do I?
Where does that come from? Have you always, you're invited there to give an opinion. Have you always, you know, were you brought up to be, well, outspoken is too strong.
Well, I was brought up in Cambridge, and I think part of my upbringing and adolescence was being with people who are passionate about things, and it was very much allowed to disagree. And I found it quite strange when I got out into a world outside Cambridge where people would assume that if you disagreed, you couldn't like each other, you couldn't be, you know, friends or lovers or whatever. And that was strange to me, because if you sat at our kitchen table, you would find us all passionately disagreeing with each other over, you know, a Latin verb or a note of Bach or whatever. So and music, that's another of my passions, an amateur passion. So I think I have a number of passions, but probably my dearest are people and words, I suppose.
People and words. Well, you mentioned music there. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But let's hear your first choice of music, which is Bach's Concerto for Two Violins. Why this one?
Oh, I love it. I love it so much. On my gap year, we didn't call it a gap year then, I lived in Paris. I play the harp in an amateur way. And I went to stay with a family. The harpist came to... She came to our family for 3 months, and then I went to their family. And we used to play this. They were a family of five children, and there was a violinist and a recorder player. And we used to play this in the evening. And I just absolutely love it. I love the Dorothy Sayers comment on this in Gaudy Night. She says, let other people have the harmony if we can have the counterpoint. And I think that's because it's two people, two violins, tussling for ascendancy, but loving each other at the same time.
That was Concerto for Two Violins by Bach, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Anne Atkins. Anne is a broadcaster, journalist and novelist. Her first novel, The Lost Child, was published in 1995. The Sunday Times described it as very readable, and the Daily Telegraph said it was excellent and original. Her second novel, On Our Own, followed in 1997, and A Fine and Private Place came out in 1999. Last month, her fourth novel, An Elegant Solution, was published. Set in Cambridge, Cambridge, it centres around Theo, a junior fellow at the university, facing down the demons of his past. Well, Anne, you talked about your Cambridge link before. There's quite a few links for you with Cambridge, aren't there?
Yes, indeed. So I was brought up in Cambridge from the age of 3 and a half till I went to university myself. Sadly, in Oxford, I'm sorry. I met Sean at Oxford and we fell in love and got married at the end of just after finals and moved back to Cambridge. We went to London for a year where I was at drama school and then came back to Cambridge for him to do his second degree. And all four of our fifth child is only 15, so give her a break. But our other four children have all been at the university, and as were my parents and my brother. And so we've got quite a connection to Cambridge.
Quite a connection. So it was a fairly easy choice to set it here. You knew the area that you're working literally.
Yes, yes. It's interesting that your theme for this today is passion. And I had to set it in Cambridge, really, because I love the place. I absolutely love it. My other three novels were set... They all have a Cambridge connection, although at the time we were living in London, which I also love. We were living in Fulham in Parsons Green, and one of them was set there. But you do have to write about what you love, actually. It's not just what you know, it's what you love. And my heart is here, so it had to be here. And I've long wanted, actually, to write a series of novels set in Cambridge, and this is intended to be the first of a number.
Well, let's hear what it's about then. What is it about?
Well, as you say, it's about Theo. I find it strange when people say to me, what's your book about? I mean, it's a novel, so it's about love and life and
everything.
People. And you can't pin down what a novel is about,
it's really hard, isn't it?
So, yes, it's about Theophilus. He is a number theorist, a mathematician, and it is a sort of a thriller in its plot. But actually, it's about the people. It's because that's what I care about. I mean, I hope it's a page turner too, because there is a sort of, you know, there's a terrorist threat and all sorts of, you know, things involving the police and the Home Office and the MI5 and all sorts of things. But it's really about the people and their loves and their... It's funny how some years ago I was thinking, I want to write a love story because that's what... The novels that really move me are about. And it's hard to think of a situation in modern life where two people don't immediately get together if they're in love, you know, because why wouldn't you? And so I was thinking of all sorts of constructs. He's a Jesuit priest or whatever it might be, or married somebody else. And I realised after I'd finished writing this that actually this is the perfect sort of frustrated love story because Theo is Aspergic. So...
Yes, he has Asperger's.
He has Asperger's syndrome. So... Obviously, his love life is going to be thwarted because he has all the complications of that.
He's very much the heart, the centre of the novel, and which makes it a very personal novel for you for another reason.
Yes, so our son Alexander is Aspergic. My middle novel of the three I wrote before in the 90s was On Our Own, which was the hero of that was Theo, actually, when he was 9, based totally 100% on Alex, at the same age as he was then, and Theo is the same age as he is now, more or less. And again, I suppose, just to come back to your theme of the day, it's because I have a passion for Alex. Obviously, it's one of my children, you know. Obviously, you have a passion for your children. Every parent does. And the way he sees the world, which I find endlessly fascinating. I always wince when people refer to Asperger's syndrome as a disability, because I know that it takes all sorts of forms, and for some people, some autistic people can be very disabled with their autism. Alex is not at all. It's a wonderful sort of refreshing privilege of the way he sees the world, which is completely wacky and different. But not at all a disability. It proved to be a disability in his early schooling because his teachers didn't understand him. And when you're a child, you're at the mercy of adults. And if they don't understand you, you can have a very, very unhappy time. And he did. But it is something I find endlessly interesting and wonderful, actually. It's like living with a foreigner all the time.
As a central character, it's quite challenging, isn't it, for a reader and for a writer, because he's a mystery even unto himself.
Yes. Of course, in a way, it makes it much easier for me. I as you will have noticed from the date of my previous novels, I've had a long and very traumatic writer's block. For reasons of things that were going on in our family that were very, very painful and difficult. And so coming out of that, I wanted to make life easy for myself because I was just desperate to write my next book. And in a way, having Alex there all the time makes it very easy because if I get stuck, I think, well, what would Alex do? And sometimes I ring him up and I say, Alex, what would you do if a cup of tea was too cold? Or what would you do if, you know, you were faced with a choice of ties? Or, I mean, most of the time I know because I know him very well, but he's able to tell me, well, I would do this, you know. So it does make it, in a way, easier knowing very, very well somebody who is right inside the head of your protagonist.
You have to make him likeable, though, to the reader. There can't be too much distance, can there? We need to like him, even if we don't understand him.
Oh, I hope the reader falls in love with him on you know, page one almost, I hope.
He's very appealing.
Oh, thank you. My husband, who's it wasn't supposed to do this, but he pinched a review copy and he's read it ahead of time. And he said to me, people are either going to hate this book or love it. I mean, I hope they're going to love it. But he said it's, in a way, it's going to depend on whether they fall in love with Theo. Because, I mean, Alex would forgive me for saying this, it can be terribly irritating. If somebody completely doesn't know whether it's Monday or Friday, it can drive you nuts. But on the other hand, if you understand where he's coming from, it doesn't drive you nuts at all. Because what's it matter? It doesn't matter whether it's Monday or Friday.
And you reference in the book, in the novel, other novels that have included autistic mm-hmm. characters. You mm-hmm. reference The Rosie Project, The yep. Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, of yep. course. What's your opinion of those?
Oh, well, I bow to Alex's opinion of the dog in that, the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, which I think it's a great book, and I admire any writer whose book does well, anybody, right? I found it a little bit two-dimensional. And Alex said, it's not about a person, it's about a collection of clichés about autism, which I thought was very interesting. I mean, he didn't say that as criticism, actually. He said it's fiction, so why not? If you can make the right, you know, if the reader's enjoying himself or herself, it doesn't matter. The Rosie Project, I laughed and laughed. The first few pages I found irritating because I thought, again, this is a cliche about autism. But actually, I fell in love with the character. I mean, yeah. So I found it a bit far-fetched in the plot, but that doesn't matter. So I did enjoy that very much.
The use of humour there is quite interesting, isn't it? Because there are moments we laugh yeah. at Theo, but we're not laughing at his disability. We're laughing at the sort of expression of it somehow.
It's not a disability, Lee.
I beg your pardon. I knew I wasn't supposed to say that word. That was why it's foremost in my head, don't say.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's got a different way of seeing the world and that can be very funny. So, yeah, it's my ambition has always been, I mean, you know, aspirations of grandeur, like Dickens, to bring laughter and tears. And I hope that's what Theo does, that he makes you laugh and sometimes makes you cry.
Well, yes, we'll come back to you and we'll talk more about Theo. As we say, Theo very much facing down the demons from his childhood. So let's hear now from Azelna Lawrence, because she's a children's life coach and founder of Kids Life Studio, which has representatives in 19 countries. Her book, The Secret Parent, was published this year on Mental Health Day. It's subtitled The Hidden Truths of Life, Parenting and Childhood Through the Eyes of a Kids Life Coach. When I met Azelna, I started by asking her, what is a children's life coach?
So a kids life coach is a person who is a professional and as a career works with children in terms of supporting them with any challenges that they may be facing.
So how do you do that? Is that through therapy sessions, through play, through art, through talking?
It's definitely not therapy. It's the total opposite of therapy. We look very much at preventative skills training and we use play as the language of childhood and we support children in learning about their mindset and their brain physiology, how that works and how to make better choices in life.
And how did you get to be in this role of work?
I started as a teacher in 1996 and I just honestly was attracted to the children with problems, labelled with problems, challenging children, and I was always looking for inventive ways to support them. So I didn't realise at the time that I was a natural kids life coach. I got the best out of them and the other teachers could never understand how the naughty kids were always good with me. And so I just eventually became disillusioned with the education system and I left and started my business 15 years ago.
And why were the naughty kids good with you?
Because I respected them and I didn't attach labels to them. Every day was a clean slate, gave them a fresh start every single day. I gave them strategies to communicate their needs, because when a child misbehaves, it's because their needs aren't being met. And so it was a mutual trust and respect that was built between us. And also something that I call the four U's: unconditional, unconventional, upbeat, upliftment. So if it meant putting on a clown suit or standing on my head, I would do whatever it took to get the best out of those kids.
So given all that experience, was it a natural next step to write a book?
Yes, absolutely. So the classroom was just such a big inspiration. The children in the classroom were an inspiration for me to write my book. The seeds were planted without me even knowing here in an inner city London school, where I had a short-term supply teaching position working with what were termed as problem children during the SATs exams and preparing them for numeracy and literacy. And in the 3 months I worked with them, it turned out I worked more on their self-esteem and confidence and building a skill set for them than I did on the numeracy and literacy. And hooray, hooray, they actually passed and everybody thought it was a miracle. But I hadn't done rocket science things. So my love for that and the seeds were planted there. So that's actually chapter two in my book, Kids in the Attic.
Well, chapter two. So talk me through just briefly some of the other chapters, how people might use this book.
So the book is really a journey through my eyes as a kids' life coach and my views on life, childhood and parenting, and the lessons that children have taught me that I've had the privilege of working with. The chapters are based on individual children that I've worked with or groups of children. So one of my favorite chapters is taking a bath in cold jelly. And that's one of my beautiful clients who, she came to me when she was 12, and that was like 10, 11 years ago. And I'm still in contact with her. She was mentally challenged and also had cerebral palsy. And she came to me for assertiveness training. In that time, I didn't realize that she was actually coaching me, because I had a fear of heights. We were talking about fears. And she told me that she had climbed this tall indoor structure, a climbing wall. And I thought, oh, how would she have done that? She's got cerebral palsy and why can't I do it? And she coached me. And eventually we went together and we climbed this wall. So that specific chapter speaks about how any child is a leader and can lead adults if we just listen to the stories that they tell and they can encourage us. So it's a beautiful chapter. There's other chapters about children who were trafficked in South Africa, which is quite a sad story. I've got a chapter in there about one of my clients who was really suicidal. There's many stories, and so it takes readers on a roller coaster of emotions. So I've had readers tell me that sometimes they would laugh at my stories because there's some really funny parts, and other times they would feel the pain of the children. So the stories are there to create an awareness of how powerful we are as adults, as role models, and also in that powerful position to always pay attention to what children can teach us, because we've lost touch with our inner child.
And would people read this from front to back, or would you see it more as a sort of self-help book in the sense that you would dip into each chapter as maybe an issue arose?
Well, it's not a self-help book as such, although every person that I've had feedback from gets something different from the book. And at the end of every chapter, there are tidbits. So there's 10 summary points that you take out of the chapter as learning points, so you can revisit those. I had two people tell me that they read the book in 2 days because they couldn't put it down because of the storytelling, and I think that's what I enjoyed the most. I didn't want a book that was just self-help, factual, telling people what to do. It's just really my views, and people take what they need from that, and everybody takes something different, which is what I love.
And it seems to me that children seem to be exhibiting more difficulties now, more mental health issues. Is that your experience?
In my experience, that is exactly what is happening, and which is why I started my organisation that deals with children's mental health and mental well-being, so that we can prevent things from spiralling out of control. What I found, and the whole premise around my book, is that it takes a village to raise a child. It's about everybody stepping in, doing their part in raising children and being good role models, and also giving children the coping skills, because our world is becoming frantic. So it is really about supporting them.
So why is there an increase in these issues for children? You said the world's becoming frantic, the social media, there seems to be more pressure on kids nowadays. Why do you think?
There's a loss of connection. So children are naturally meant to play and learn through play. So what I've noticed, especially coming from a country in South Africa where children start school at the age of 7 officially in year one, here the children are 5 in year one. Their playtime is cut down by 2 years. Lots of research has been done worldwide on the importance of play. So the problems we're seeing, I believe, is because children are not allowed to progress naturally through their developments. And when adults interfere with that development and put a child at a desk and force them to write and read and do things before they naturally get there, that's when the problems step in, because every child develops differently.
Do you still get any of that disciplinarian approach to parenting? Because what you're offering is something very different, but very child-centred, putting the child first. Do you ever come across those parents who say, you know, I just tell him, just got to get on with it, put it to one side, you know, swallow it?
Yeah, sometimes children need that. They do need that sometimes. They need an adult to tell them what the rules are. I always say there's 3 rules that parents need to have, and most of the parents I work with get this. The first one is that they need boundaries. The second one, consistency in those boundaries. And the third one is to love unconditionally, even when those boundaries are broken. So yes, I do get strict parents, but when you balance that with a careful measure of love and unconditional love, where you know your child is going to make mistakes and fall down, that's when you get it right as a parent.
Unconditional love, I mean, that's quite
it's hard.
Tough and tall order, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because we all know how, for whatever reason, how difficult and challenging and sometimes, let's face it, horrible children can be. Did I say that? I don't know.
You did say horrible. And yes, I absolutely agree with you. Sometimes children can make it hard to love them. However, it is our job as adults to make sure that they know that they're loved, especially at those times when they are being really horrible. Most adult depression, in fact, 1 in 3 adults who have depression would have developed that in childhood by the age of 14 because they weren't dealt with appropriately. They faced adverse conditions and parents just didn't listen to their needs. I'm not about a child getting away with things. Children need boundaries, but it's how you implement those.
And it's a great book, Zelna. It's very thorough, lots of chapters to it with fantastic titles, as you said. Is there one takeaway message that you would want somebody to take from the book?
Well, if I could give people one takeaway message, it's to tap into their inner child and to play more. The problems that we're seeing is that people are just so highly strung and so stressed out and don't have time for each other. There's a loss of connection. So the book is really about just tapping back into that need that we all have just to enjoy life and to just not take life so seriously. It doesn't have to be so serious. And it's only when we become too serious and we start looking at the peripheral things that actually don't mean anything when you look at the bigger picture, that's when the stress and the anxiety and the depression steps in. So when people can just tap straight back into why we were put here, and that is to be of service to others, and tap into that inner child and just go about it at a playful way, smile at people in the road, say hello to strangers. Don't teach children to be scared of strangers. So I suppose that's not one takeaway, but I'm just really passionate about people just tapping into who they are. Don't be scared to show who you are, and don't hide behind a mask, because then you'll teach children to do the same thing, and that's why people walk around unhappy.
I don't think children are horrible, really, honestly. That was Zelna Lawrence. You can find out more about her work at her website, kidslifestudio.com. And you're mother of 5 children.
Yeah, yes, what a wonderful attitude she has. I particularly warm to it because I was the most naughty one in my entire school, actually, when I was at school.
So, no, really?
Apparently, yeah. Yes, my father, who's headmaster at the time of King's Cross School in Cambridge, and he went to my school when I had just started there. I'd not only been there a term, and he was asked to be the Father Christmas. And of course, I was one of the youngest, and you never know, nobody ever knows who the youngest children are. And 2 fifth formers walked into the Father Christmas grotto, and they said, "Whose dad are you really?" And he said confidently, "Well, I'm the father of the naughtiest girl in the school." And they both immediately, unanimously said me, which was a bit of a shock.
So it's confirmed.
Yeah,
it's confirmed.
But I also love her positive attitude. I've also written a book on bringing up children, and my 3 principles are safety, security, and significance. So I agree with everything she says. Wonderful.
Excellent. Well, we're here really to talk about your novel, An Elegant Solution. We're saying it's set in Cambridge early. It's a lot about Cambridge academic life, lecturers, students, the wives of masters, porters. It's a real kaleidoscope of the university, not necessarily complimentary at all times.
Oh, really? I do love it all. Cambridge is itself, isn't it? It's not like anywhere else. And I love the way P.G. Woodhouse creates a world, a world of sort of, you know, aristocracy in the 1920s. And Cambridge is as different as that. I mean, it's a sort of intellectual aristocracy, isn't it? And where people in the university take all sorts of things for granted, which I just love. One or two of my members of the family, they've all actually stolen the review copy and they've all been reading it. And they've said, "Do you not explain any of the jokes?" And I said, "Well, no, you couldn't explain the jokes because they wouldn't be funny anymore." And some of them, because some of these people are very, very clever people, you know, some of their jokes are quite sort of subtle. And I'm hoping that it's the sort of book that you can read through quickly and not necessarily get everything. But then you might want to read it again and go, "Oh, yes." In fact, my son, Alex, said to me a week or two ago, "Oh, I suddenly understand that joke about his name, Theophilus." And I said, "Oh, Alex, how can you not have got that?" But he hadn't. So it's affectionate. We all have foibles, but I almost every person in this book I love. The out and out baddie in it. My son Alexander said, one doesn't have the sympathy with him that one does for the other baddies. I mean, there are a number of baddies, and I actually love them all. So I hope one can sort of... That's something I've got. I touched very briefly on the fact that I did a theatre drama training as well. I worked as an actor for a while. And one of the things you learn as an actor is you have to love the character you're playing, whether it's Lady Macbeth or it's... I played Lady Capulet in my 20s, actually, and I found it very difficult to understand her attitude to Juliet. But you have to. You have to get to the point where you go, actually, yes, she's right. Whatever she's doing, Lady Macbeth is right to feel this. And that's when you get the passion for the people, and that's when the people become... when they come alive and the reader can love them too.
Well, you've brought me beautifully to our next section. You mentioned Alexander there. We're going to hear Alexander now, aren't we? Because he performs in this extract of your novel. So just give us a little bit of context to this. And this also includes your second choice of music, we should say.
Indeed it does. So this is about halfway through. So the Bach that we heard appears early in the book. It's, I think, as I was listening to it just then, I thought, this is really music to fall in love to. And Theo, and there's a girl in the novel, a first year undergraduate called Charlotte. And we love Charlotte too, I hope. And the Bach, they hear together, they bump into each other, then go to a concert together. And this piece is sort of in the second half of the book. It's after the end of term, it's after Advent, and they're both still up in Cambridge, and it's pouring with rain, and she's a bit homesick, and he's, for reasons I won't bother you with, got her violin in his room, her best violin, and she suddenly realises she wants to play music with somebody, and she goes round to see him.
Oh, this is great. This is so what Cambridge should be.
Should be.
You know what I mean.
No idea. Ah, Les Mis. You played this before?
My godmother took me when I was 12.
Oh, then you'll know it better than I do. How on earth did I come by this? Easier for me than you, I think.
Wait. Okay, ready.
Thank you.
Theo, you're crying.
No, I'm not. Just my eyes are. Anne played that to me once, when I was at school. Or rather, very much not at school. Silly, really, because I was home.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have laughed.
It's absolutely the right thing to do. The only possible response to the potency of cheap music. The Mendelssohn's much better anyway.
Mendelssohn?
Hear my prayer. All for the wings of a dove, far away, far...
It is, really.
I sang that for my voice trial when I was 7. That was a good bit earlier when you did that twiddle, what do you call it?
Acciaccatura. Or appoggiatura, perhaps.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing you can only remember for 10 seconds, isn't it? Like, I don't know, structuralism or... I once knew a man who knew the difference. Also said his father was John Lennon and he understood post-postmodernism.
I do, actually. Know the difference. Oh, hang on. I should have taken them off before.
You wore those before? Those earrings?
Well, I often wear them. They're my winter colours. Ice, snow, sky.
Shh.
I like...
Yes.
Can I help? You don't seem very happy.
No, thank you. I might break. I didn't want to remember. Harold, Shroud. He was strange, but you don't know that as a child. Expelled. He tried to kill me, I think. Possibly more than once. He still hates me. I knew all along, I just didn't know I knew. Because it hurt too much.
Here, have this. You might want this to dry your hair.
I know where it is, and why the dogs didn't find it. I suppose this is urgent, which means it's very important that we don't rush it. Bring your coat. Do you have a hat or something? I have an umbrella, somewhere.
Here it is.
Wallet, telephone, gloves, scarf, knitting, no, New Testament, no, tooth, no, keys, yes. Your fiddle.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And we were listening there to an extract from An Elegant Solution by our studio guest today on Bookmark, Anne Atkins. It starred Alexander Atkins and son Lana Bruce and was produced by Matt Bentman. And we've talked about the Asperger's in the book. There seem to me, well, there's lots of themes in the book. The other great thing that you really explore is cryptocurrency and maths,
yes.
Really. And there is a connection, obviously.
Yes.
How much did you know about either of those things before? Because you write about them very confidently.
Oh, dear. Gosh, I struggled with that cryptocurrency. So I was telling you this is coming out of a long and very difficult, very painful writer's block. And when I, which is actually a lot to do with our daughter has been very, very ill and we've had a number of challenges, including Alex's, because he had a very difficult childhood because his schools didn't understand him. I sort of started writing this about 5 years. Well, I actually started writing it about 10 years ago, but, you know, properly about 5 years ago. It shouldn't have taken me this long, but I was coming out of a very difficult place. And at that time, nobody had heard of cryptocurrency, so it's really sort of cutting edge. And Alex, as it happens, did very well on Bitcoin. He told me about it long before anyone had heard of it. He said, do you want to, I'll invest some money for you in this thing that I'd never heard of. And he said, only give me what you're happy to waste. To lose, you know. I gave him £1,000 when bitcoins were worth Oh, golly. Not pence, but, you know, not very much. And I've still got 10 bitcoins, which is terribly exciting. So that's why I wanted to write about something that nobody had heard. Of course, everybody's heard of it now. And I cursed myself over and over again because I really struggle to understand. My mother was a mathematician. She's a math teacher, a very wonderful math teacher. She taught Andrew Wiles, who proved Fermat's Last Theorem. She taught all sorts of very impressive Cambridge people, actually. But the number of tutorials Alex had to give me on this cryptocurrency, and I thought, why did I bite off something I find so hard to chew? But I did also think, if I can understand it, then at least my reader will be able to understand it. And the plot, that little extract we heard there, is they're foiling a really frightening terrorist plot, actually. And Theo is the only person who has the information, and he doesn't know. He knows he has the information, but he can't work out what it is that he knows that nobody else knows. And it hangs on the cryptocurrency and his specialist knowledge of it. And the book is very meticulously researched, and I asked my police source. I had several police sources, but one is a very close friend. You know, are there situations in which the police would use an academic because the academic would know more than the police? Because again, a challenge with a modern whodunit is, you know, why wouldn't the police solve it? Because they would, you know. But he said, oh yeah, there would be some things that an academic would know more about. And Theo is that academic. He's the only person who has the knowledge that can foil this terrifying plot.
And so, you did make life hard for yourself, not just cryptocurrency there, but there is quite a lot about maths in it.
There's a very exciting mathematical breakthrough.
There is a mathematical breakthrough.
Theo changes the mathematical world during the course of the novel.
Yes, yeah. Some of that, I have to say, went a little over my head, but well, I guess sense the excitement of
you
it very
and me
much.
Both.
there's the information about Asperger's. Also, there is a lot about King's College.
Yes, indeed.
And the chapel.
Yes.
You seem to know that chapel very well.
I do know that chapel. It's never named. It's never named as King's. So if you were Chinese or American, you might have no idea which college it's in. But anyone who's walked through Cambridge once will recognise it straight away. Yes, I love King's. Again, we're talking about passions. My spiritual home is King's Chapel. My father was I mentioned this already, the headmaster of the choir school. I was brought up there. I spent much of my adolescence in that beautiful building listening to that beautiful music. And I feel, along with Charlotte to some extent and Theo totally, that if that were to be lost, part of my soul would be lost. So yes, I do know King's very well. My daughter is a member of King's. My father is a member of King's. I didn't apply to King's because I was so scared that I wouldn't get in. And that's why I went to Oxford, because I thought, if I can't go to King's, I don't want to go to Cambridge.
Well, you describe it beautifully. Well, we're talking about King's there. Let's hear from somebody from another college now. We'll come back to you in a moment, Anne. Ted Powell was a fellow and director of studies in history at Downing College, Cambridge. His book, King Edward VIII, An American Life, examines Edward's fascination with America. Juliet Gardner has described it as the fullest, most revealing and perceptive biography of King Edward VIII. I started by asking Ted why he'd written the book.
Well, I've always been fascinated by the events of the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936. And it's always puzzled me, the question as to why it was that the king voluntarily abdicated the throne and, you know, gave up, really abandoned his duty, left his post, if you like, but supposedly for love of an American divorcee. And I've always wondered really whether that is the whole story or whether there is a more complicated long-term explanation. And that was the original inspiration for the book, really. It's specifically concerned with King Edward VIII and America. So his lifelong love affair with all things American and his ultimately doomed attempt to reconcile that love with his duty, his destiny as heir to the British throne and the British Empire.
So you said supposedly for love of a woman there. Do you not actually believe that was the reason he abdicated?
Well, I think he was undoubtedly in love with her. There's no doubt about that. Indeed, he was obsessed and infatuated. But there's always been some suspicion that he was, in a way, looking for a way out, that the idea of being king was not one which appealed to him at all. There is an argument, in addition, that there was an establishment plot, if you like, led by the Archbishop of Canterbury and also the then Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin to get rid of Edward, simply didn't regard him as being suitable as a king. Those are all quite well-established arguments, but what I've tried to set out in my book is an argument that, in fact, by 1936, Edward is a thoroughly Americanized figure, that, you know, as long ago as 1919, he has visited the United States and is full of wonder and admiration for all things American. And I think he really sees at that time, 100 years ago almost exactly, that the future of the sort of world leadership, if you like, lies with America for that century. And the British Empire is on the way down. Many sort of British leaders came to that conclusion at the same time, but they did not admire America in the same way that Edward did. Partly, I think, because he was a very young man and come from the terrible experiences of the First World War. He'd served on the Western Front, although he wasn't allowed to fight because he was the Prince of Wales. He was the heir to the throne. But he had seen all those horrors at first hand. And then coming to America with all its vigour, its energy, its confidence, it completely bowled him over. And from that time onwards, he was really keen to spend as much time as he could in America and adopted American dress. He bought American cars. He made American friends. And, of course, he took American lovers.
And how did that go down at home?
Of course, in those days, the British press was extremely restrained and deferential in terms of what they reported about the royal family. America was completely different. But in Britain, there was very little knowledge of his private life at all. The contrast with America was very strong because, of course, there was no restraint in the States as to what the papers reported. So, ironically, the American public knew all about his many affairs with American women in the 20s and 30s, whereas in Britain, none of that was reported. And, of course, notoriously, in 1936, during the abdication crisis, there was no murmur of Edward's affair with Wallis Simpson until right at the very end, until about a week before he abdicated, and then it burst upon a sort of horrified and unsuspecting nation.
You suggest in your book that he had two personas, as it were.
Yes, that's right. He was always, as I say, was always uncomfortable with his royal role. And certainly, once he had discovered America, he almost began to develop two different personas. On the one hand, there is the quintessentially English Edward, Prince of Wales, and later as King. And on the other hand, there's David. His sort of family name was David. And this was a shy figure, lacking in confidence, full of admiration for the United States and pursuing a very Americanized lifestyle, largely, of course, in private when he was in Britain.
You've talked about his role as king in the book. Doing the research for it, did it make you feel any differently about him as a person?
At the end of the book, I suppose, I did feel a huge sympathy with Edward, because he is a very ordinary man doing an extraordinary job and working in extraordinary circumstances. And I think we might all of us wonder how we would react if we had that extraordinarily difficult job to do. But I also felt quite impatient with him, because there was a strong feeling at the time that he very much let the country down. He'd abandoned his duty as king, whereas, you know, hundreds of thousands of young men of his generation had laid down their lives for the country during the First World War, and he wasn't even prepared to set aside his love affair in order to do his duty as king.
Now, you've got some memorabilia
here.
Yes, this is a small section of your memorabilia.
It is, I'm afraid, yes. My house is full of it, and my drives my wife crazy.
Talk us through a few things here.
One of the things about Edward was that in his life as Prince of Wales in particular, there was a huge industry of royal memorabilia, particularly focused on Edward. So, for example, we have all sorts of badges for different events that he was involved in. One of my favourites here is a very large mug, probably not designed for drinking, but if you pick it up...
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
You can actually...
And you say very large mug, that is, and it's in the shape of his head and his face.
That's right, and that, of course, is playing the national anthem.
And that was made at the time?
Yes, that's right. It was such a large industry that his abdication was a complete catastrophe. We have, for example, a photograph here of a factory which was devoted to manufacturing busts of Edward VIII. The report at the time records that the manufacturers were losing millions of pounds because, of course, they had to throw away all the busts of Edward VIII which they manufactured because nobody was going to buy them.
And there was a huge deference to the royal family at this time, and I suppose Edward, he's a good-looking man.
He was a bit of a matinee idol, and in America he was compared with the sort of great Hollywood stars. He was as popular as Clark Gable or Douglas Fairbanks.
And from his story, can we learn anything today about our attitude to the royals?
It was a very different time back in the 20s and 30s between the wars. The monarchy then, I suppose, the House of Windsor, was at the height of its popularity. In the First World War and right through into the Second World War, it was very much the focus of national identity and solidarity, much more central to public life, I think, than it is now. We have learnt a little bit, and I think things have moved on, because there is an obvious comparison to be made between Edward's marriage to Wallis Simpson, an American divorcee, and Prince Harry's recent marriage to Meghan Markle. And Meghan, of course, is herself an American divorcee. So it's quite encouraging, I think, that whereas poor Wallis was isolated and ostracised by the British establishment and Edward had to leave his throne in order to marry her, Meghan has been embraced by the British people and also by the royal family, and the signs are that she is going to be a very popular member of the royal family.
And what's his legacy?
His legacy was a mixed one. I think, in a way, the royal family drew the wrong conclusions from his abdication. In his time, he was a very modernising figure and arguably was the inventor of the modern style of monarchy, because he took a big step away from the very sort of formal, pageant-heavy ceremonial of royal occasions. He was the first really to go out amongst the people. He invented the royal walkabout, you know, 50 years before Queen Elizabeth started doing it. He had a reputation very much as a democratic prince in the 1920s and 1930s. And one of his areas of activity, which is completely lost now, is his very active support for the unemployed, his campaigns for improved housing for working people, which he really majored on in the late 20s and 30s during the Depression. The royal family reacted to the abdication by reverting to a rather more traditional form of monarchy, which Edward and George's father, King George V, had espoused. It rather held them back in the years that followed.
And he has figured a lot in films. We've had and on TV,
so.
We've had The Crown, The King's Speech, Edward and Mrs. Simpson some years ago.
That's right.
Is there one image or one depiction of him that you think rings true?
He does pop up with some frequency, and of course most notably The Crown, where he's played quite well, I think, by Alex Jennings in terms of the portrayal. It does, in my mind, perpetuate the myth of Edward as a shallow, pleasure-loving playboy who developed Nazi sympathies, and you know, we were well rid of him. Although there are elements of truth in that, I don't think it's the whole story, and I think it presents a view which is greatly oversimplified, and really that, in a sense, was what the book was about, to try to present a more three-dimensional picture of Edward. And I hope he comes out as a rather more human and rounded figure than the myth that we see on the TV all too often.
And King Edward VIII, An American Life by Ted Powell, is published by Oxford University Press. We've been talking to Anne Atkins on Bookmark here about her novel, An Elegant Solution. It's published by Malcolm Down Publishing. And some of the royalties, Anne, go to the Autism Centre for Excellence, is that right?
That's right. This is a very exciting project in Cambridge itself. Not built yet. It's fundraising now. And I am hugely grateful personally to the work of Professor Simon Baron-Cohen, who works in autism and Asperger's syndrome, director of the Autism Research Trust. And this is really to sort of thank him particularly and people like him who are working to bring about understanding of autism.
And it's a good Christmas present, isn't it?
Well, it ends on Christmas Day. It follows, well, 2018, it starts at midsummer and goes through from midsummer right up to Christmas Day 2018. And it's very important that it's 2018, as you discover when you read it, and it ends on Christmas Day. So I'm hoping that it would be, because it's the sort of thing I would love. My husband always gives me books for Christmas, the latest hardbacks out, and it's the sort of thing I would love to read at Christmas because it ends on a Christmassy theme.
And what now for you? You were mentioning that you might want to take some of these characters forward a little.
Yes, I'm hoping, well, planning that this will be the first of at least a trilogy about Theo and possibly more. So the next one, I've been wanting to start on it for some time now, for some weeks or even months, but this book is taking on its own momentum, so I'm doing a lot of this sort of lovely thing, talking about it. But that's the next Theo book. I'm also writing a daily blog about our daughter's devastating illness. It's called Bink Bonkers, is the blog. And that is quite a commitment because I always post every morning. So that's...
Wow.
Yeah, and that's quite an emotional commitment as well. And I find I've come to understand my writing a bit better and why I couldn't write for 20 years. And it's actually because my writing takes so much of me that when my children were going through a difficult time, our daughter's illness, Alice's Asperger's syndrome, we were even homeless for a while, there wasn't enough of me left over to love other people, the fictional people in my book. And that's, I now understand why I couldn't write for 20 years.
And we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I've just started reading my first Julie Cohen, the book Together. I came across Julie Cohen because actually a reader of my blog very generously, reading about some of the trauma we've been through, has offered to pay for me to go on retreat, which is wonderful. So I've been looking at writers' retreats, and Julie Cohen is a writer who runs retreats. In fact, the one I wanted to go on was booked, so she's obviously very popular, but it got me looking at her work. So I've just started that. I'm just two chapters in, which is lovely. It starts with the love of two people in their 80s. So I'm enjoying that.
Lovely. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment to introduce your final choice of music. Just a heads up that our next show studio guest is Martine McDonagh. She's talking about her novel, I Have Waited and You Have Come. We'll also hear from poet Helen Ivory and stonecutter and author Leda Kindersley. We'll sign out with your last choice of music now, which is Vincent by Don McLean. We're desperately trying to fade up at the appropriate part here, which I will do. So why this one?
Well, all these pieces of music appear in the book. The girl Charlotte gives the CD of the Don McLean to Theo for a Christmas present. As I say, the book ends on Christmas Day. He rings her by mistake. This is very typical of Theo. He's supposed to be ringing his girlfriend and he rings Charlotte by mistake. And I first called the book not An Elegant Solution, but As Beautiful As You from these lyrics, because that is how my son Alex and Theo strike me as in some ways too beautiful for this world, too vulnerable. And like the character in the Don McLean, Alex tried to kill himself or nearly killed himself, I should say, as did Theo earlier in his childhood.
Thank you, Anne. Lovely talking to you.
What you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free, they would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now, for they could not love you, but still your love was true. And when no hope was left in sight on that starry, starry night, you took your life as lovers often do. But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful